PFLAG Canada is there when it seems no one else is. Are you struggling with an LGBT issue? Every day, PFLAG Canada volunteers are contacted by frightened kids and by angry, fearful, or ashamed parents. PFLAG is Canada's only national organization that helps all Canadians who are struggling with issues of sexual orientation and gender identity. PFLAG Canada supports, educates, and provides resources 24/7. Visit pflagcanada.ca.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Few Canadian elections in recent memory have captivated the public's attention like the one we are in right now. The looming threats from America have dominated the discourse surrounding the election, turning what polls showed to be a likely landslide for the Conservatives into a tight race focused on that central issue of economic health and sovereignty.
The things directed at Canada, it's just not something I've ever seen before.
I want us to be, I guess, almost like resilient.
Problems with the U.S. right
just
now.
Just like supporting Canada.
If you're like me, nearly all of the coverage you've seen about this election has been focused on Donald Trump's tariffs, with each potential leader stating how they will respond. And while this is an extremely crucial issue for our country, I was also curious to see whether it was the number one issue outside of the newsroom or the press conference, or if the public had other concerns that could play a role in their vote. That's why I ventured around SFU's Burnaby campus on a sunny Thursday to ask students about the issues that, in their opinion, were important to them in the upcoming election. So, let's hear from the people. So, are you aware of the upcoming federal election?
I am.
Yes, I am.
Yes, I am.
Yes, of course I am.
Yes.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, there was one issue that dominated conversation. What do you think the most important issue is?
I think, like, beyond just, like, student stuff, I feel like a lot of flack and stuff is coming from, like, the U.S., so I'm a little bit, I think that's my biggest concern. Like, I want us to be, I guess, almost, like, resilient in regards to, like, the threats that are being placed upon us by the United States.
I think the most important issue for me is just their policy with handling, like, foreign affairs and, you know, just their vision for how companies should cooperate and just, like, engage in trade and stuff like that.
I'm concerned about the problems with the U.S. right now, with the trade war and the tariffs and whatnot, and
absolutely,
how that's going to affect our economy and daily lives.
I would say, you know, it's scary, some of the things that are going on south of the border right now. There's a lot of the things directed at Canada. It's just not something I've ever seen before. And ensuring our own security in this situation, I think, is the most important. And that is both political security, economic security, and defensive security.
One person even clearly addressed their fears of American influence on one of the parties.
For you personally, what's the most important issue?
Not having our government be fascist.
Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I think that the Conservative government has a lot of communication with some far-right individuals in the South Pacific, specifically in the U.S., and is getting a lot of funding from them for their campaigns, and I don't agree with what they want to do in terms of how they control the government. Yeah.
Gotcha. And where have you seen this information about their funding?
Just around.
And then as a student.
Particularly about Daniel Smith.
However, while all students took the tariff seriously, some also had different issues that took priority, often related to personal backgrounds and experience.
I think talk about the tariffs is obviously important. Talk about immigration is something I'm looking into for each of the candidates, and then also key environmental issues. How about you?
I definitely think, like, focusing on our economy right now is probably the main idea. So
yeah,
That's what I'm probably gonna think about in regards to that.
Absolutely, and just like supporting Canada as a whole.
The most important issue would me personally, it's pharmacare and education.
Why those?
Well, first, I think being able to afford medication is very important. Like, as with healthcare, like, well, after you get your healthcare, you need to be able to get a way to, like, afford your medications, that otherwise the healthcare doesn't really do much if you can't, like, prolong your health with medications. And with education, I mean, I'm a student, and my brother, he's heading into university soon. It's very expensive to be a student, and to have some of that covered by the government would help out a lot of people.
The opinions of these students can have a big impact. We are a population that can often deeply feel the burden of inflation, the housing crisis, and cuts to social services. We also have a sizable influence, as there is roughly 330,000 post-secondary students in BC, or just under 6% of the province, who can vote in the upcoming election. The students I talk to have clear ideas about how they want to see the federal government support them and their peers, and that most often comes back to their pocketbooks and being heard. How do you think our politicians can support university students specifically, or young people in general? Is there anything as a student that you'd want to see from the next federal government?
I guess if there were to be any problems with club funding, I feel like that's really important. I feel like the initiatives that we have here and the initiatives that are starting to arise at SFU that are focused on community and connection are important at SFU, but also all other universities. And that's kind of all that I could think of right now. I feel like SFU itself does a pretty good job at the work-study program and providing bursaries for students, from what I've heard, so that's not something I'm too concerned about.
I think that there can be a lot of work to support, like, university students when it comes to, like, certain benefits and costs. I know for a lot of university students that I know personally, there's a lot of issues with, like, healthcare that they don't see as much support in and that they think they could get more out of, and I personally also think that that should be something that our current politicians should look at more.
I mean, anything related to, like, the improvement of like, infrastructure, anything related to, like, budget for, you know, post-secondary and education, I think is good. And, I mean, for me, I think that would be, like, the biggest thing. I think that things can, there are plenty of issues and stuff with, like, budget cuts and stuff around here. I mean, UBC, I think, too, has some. And, I mean, I feel like that would be the biggest thing, just getting more money into this stuff, you know, allowing more student events, more, you know, more ambitious, like, things in the future for that.
Probably by actually talking to students. I don't know that there's been a significant effort for parties to do that, because I haven't seen that. So, yeah, I feel like as someone who is fairly into politics, like, that seems like a kind of gap in communication.
I think subsidies for student programs, for example, like, extracurriculars for students, and, like, as it goes for, like, more younger kids, it's a lot of times it can be difficult for them to break into any field of extracurriculars, because it can be quite expensive. And definitely one way to help is that they could subsidize some of the costs, like a rebate that would help students, like, have some extra money to pay for whatever programs they wanted to take.
Well, it would be nice if, you know, the necessities, the things that we consume, like food and whatnot, were more affordable. But of course, that is an ongoing issue. I mean, rent is high, you know, everything is expensive.
Yeah, but affordability, right?
Yeah, affordability is quite a problem, at least for, you know, I think many students and just people of this age in general.
People in our situation would primarily be looking at the are at risk from the economic side of things currently going on. There's also the fact that we are an activist community to some extent, whether by choice or by association, and that carries ideas that are under challenge right now, both in the country and outside of it. Yeah, I would love to see making sure that our student body is free to still express their opinions and to make their voices heard without fear, and to be ensured that we are not overly economically burdened by the situation, that we have paths forward and that we have guarantees on that.
The American threat is certainly discomforting for Canadians, but it has also united many of us. The common element between all of the voices you just heard is that they are passionate about this election, ensuring that they elect decision makers who will keep their future and their country secure. And if you want to make sure that you have the information and knowledge to make such a decision, well, these students have some advice.
You know, you seem pretty informed about politics, so how do you follow politics if our listeners want to get more involved?
I think ever since getting to university and, like, living in residence, it's a bit harder for me to keep up with the news and everything. But I think that personally it's very important to keep informed. So I'll go out of my way to, you know, watch, like, news videos on YouTube and look into certain sources and making sure that I double check everything, like, not just believe everything that I see on, like, social media and stuff.
Listen to various news sources and cross-reference them and look at the information that is consistent and who is consistently saying what.
Liam McCarragirio, CGSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Hey, do you want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at supportblackcharities.org.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. The Down Syndrome Resource Foundation, or the DSRF, is a Burnaby-based nonprofit organization that provides group programs for youth and adults with Down syndrome, one-to-one services for individuals and families at all stages of life, and Down syndrome resources to equip parents, caregivers, and professionals. One of these main services is their employment service program, which has been proven successful in connecting clients of the DSRF that are looking for work with local businesses looking to hire. To learn more about the program and the reasons behind its success, CJSF reached out to Asia Masters, the employment specialist for the DSRF, for an interview on this employment support program. Please take a listen.
I got an opportunity right out of high school to work with people with disabilities. I was like a summer coordinator, and I got to do really fun things kind of all summer with a variety of different people. And that sort of sparked my interest in working with people with disabilities. So I geared my education towards that. I actually came to SFU and minored in learning and developmental disabilities and a major in psychology. But in one of my minor courses, a professor of mine actually works at DSRF. And she was like, we're always looking for volunteers. So I went there and volunteered for a summer, and I just knew that that was where I had to work. So when I graduated, I reached out to them and got a job. I was a teaching assistant originally, and I was working with our young adults, and when they were graduating from our young adult programs, I noticed that almost none of them had jobs or were obtaining employment, and they're all hardworking, smart, driven, you know, they want employment. So I went back to school to become an employment specialist. That I graduated in 2020, unfortunately, so that was a bit of, you know, the whole world was on hold, but so for the past like 2 or 3 years is kind of when things have really kind of progressed with the employment program and the things that we're offering there.
Can you kind of run by the process that the DSRF goes through when it comes to connecting local businesses with the people in the program?
Mm-hmm. So when I work with clients, I try to find what they're interested in and then what area of the city they live in, and then ideally matching those things together, you know, close to home and their interest. Not always possible, but I do my best. So currently it's sort of cold calling employers, seeing if somebody's hiring, if there's interest. I have a couple clients who have really successful employment, very inclusive. They're doing really well. They're like part of the employment family of where they're working. And those people called me and were like, we have a place, or we're excited to explore. I'm hiring somebody with Down syndrome. So that's what I kind of thought, you know, doing those one-on-one calls, that's great for a couple clients, but it doesn't really hit on the like larger systemic barriers around employment. So trying to reach larger groups of people that are hoping to be interested in employment.
Are there any specific examples that you could give of like a success story or something like that where, you know, the work that you're doing really showed a positive result?
Yeah, so I'll give you two, actually. One is recently in Burnaby. I went to a Burnaby Board of Trade event, and I connected with some people from a retirement living home. And a couple weeks ago, maybe about a month and a half ago, a client of mine is now volunteering there once a week for happy hour, where they serve drinks and snacks. And my client goes and he helps with that service. And it's made like a really big difference in the retirement, the home there. You can see the clients or the residents are really happy. My client is thrilled to share what he does when he comes back. And actually just this morning before I walked in, I got an email from his employer there saying that he was looking forward to seeing the client and it's his favorite part of the week. So that is just awesome. It's nice to see, you know, success around employment. And then there was one in Vancouver, a coffee shop, who they contacted me looking to hire somebody with Down syndrome, and he's now been working there. It's been 2 or 3 years, and they are their family. He goes to their like private events that they have, their friend groups. They have lunch. The owners have lunch with my client and his mother. So it really is just like it worked really well. They're completely part of the community.
One thing I was curious about had to do with the skill building mm-hmm. aspect of the work you do. How does that work? You know, like, because obviously there's going to be a wide array of things to work on. So where does that skill building capacity come from with the DSRF?
So the DSRF, we offer, our goal as an organization is like support across the lifespan. So infants come in and do feeding and occupational therapy and speech therapy, reading therapy, sexual education, kind of all across the lifespan. So, you know, we're trying to get individuals starting earlier talking about employment. And that means, you know, practicing asking for help and doing independent things in the kitchen or dressing or things, you know, when they can be independent, doing those things. Talking about jobs out in the community. So, you know, if you go to the coffee shop, looking at the barista or the person making the drinks, or if you're at a grocery store, the person stocking and the person, and pointing out those things. So we're a bit more aware of kind of building those skills earlier. In terms of direct work that I'm doing with clients, they'll come, you know, with differing skills. We talk about like personal hygiene is good, being on time for work, you know, relationships at work, because that can be tricky. What are, you know, friends versus coworkers, and where does that line, where's that line drawn? Talking about appropriate conversations, so different topics that are appropriate for different coworkers. So those are some of the general skills that we talk about. And then working with a client, if they have specific skills, if it's working at a restaurant, being a host, practicing those, you know, communication skills and stuff like that. So it can be geared towards the client.
In interacting with these businesses, are there any sort of misconceptions that you've come across that you've had to sort of quell as part of your job?
I think there's a lot of bias around hiring somebody with a disability in general. I think businesses are scared kind of how to dip their toes in. They're not really sure what accommodations might look like, what sort of things that they're going to have to change in their business to create a space for this individual, when really there's not many things that are different. And actually often if I make materials or training visuals or something for one of my clients so they can, you know, get better access at work, employers are often, like they mentioned, they're like, oh, this is great for future employees. And it's that sort of universal design for learning, where if it's good for one person, it's often good for the kind of the majority. So I would say kind of the fear of the unknown. And then, yeah, just not really knowing where to get started with accommodations or what that might look like for somebody.
Yeah, one of the last things I want to ask you is if you can provide like what you believe to be like some of the central benefits for businesses that decide to get involved with the DSRF in this capacity.
Individuals who have Down syndrome, they are eager to work. It's an untapped kind of workforce. They're now, with our medical system and the way things are changing, folks with Down syndrome are living longer, and they have all the same dreams as goals as we do. And the research shows that if people are working at a place with, or they're hired, somebody's hired who has Down syndrome, the employee retention is longer, they take less sick time and less vacation time, they often are like never late and show up more punctual to work, and it just changes the entire workforce. So it's good for business, it's good for you know, the coworkers people have and the relationships they can build at work. But then also, if, you know, if somebody's at a grocery store or a coffee shop and people are coming in and, you know, customers are coming in, they see somebody who has Down syndrome or see somebody with a disability, they're often to come back to that establishment because it's an inclusive environment. So it's really, it's good for business. And yeah, it's a, they're eager to work and they have a lot to offer.
Once again, that was our conversation with Asia Masters, the employment specialist for the Down Syndrome Resource Foundation in Burnaby, BC, and the foundation's employment support program. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This segment was made possible by the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Cooperatives and Mutuals Canada is honored to host the annual CMC Congress from June 10 to June 12 at the Hotel Saskatchewan in Regina, Saskatchewan. Under this year's theme, The Future is Co-op, join us for thought-provoking plenaries and participate in interactive workshops and breakout sessions. To learn more or register, please visit www.canada.coop now.
So, hi everyone. This is another episode of Speak Up. I would like to welcome Dr. Hira, Dr. Andy Hira. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Andy Hira from the Department of Political Science, and I run the Clean Energy Research Group here at SFU.
And yes, so our interview basically today will focus a little bit on the current momentum for Canada when it comes to sustainable energy. We're going to be overlooking some policies over the last years and also talking about how the tariffs and the war on tariffs is going to affect both Canada and the US when it comes to sustainable investments in clean energy. So I think that's maybe just a good question to set up the mood and for us to start. Is there anything funny that you do on a day-to-day basis that you would like to share? Like when you have time, because I know you're super busy.
anything funny? Well, I would say that all academic life is pretty absurd. That is, we often argue about very small things that seem like big things to the people that are involved in those discussions.
I see where you're coming from. I had to recent class... Introduction to Microeconomics, and the professor was really into those small debates, especially with professors from political sciences, and yeah, he would usually jump into the economic discussions, and he has a particularly strong opinion about COVID, so I know where you're coming from. It's like these discussions usually, they're so big when you're in it, and you find it funny, right?
It's funny because we tend to lack perspective. We're supposed to be public intellectuals, but somehow some of us are too far removed from reality to be very useful in that role.
I see. Well, let's begin with talking a little bit about policy. I think that's a way that research usually tries to engage a lot and then actually can lead to changes when at least researchers are heard. So I think that's just to introduce everyone that is hearing to this, can you talk a little bit more about the currently situation when it comes to sustainable energy investments in Canada? So what do you know about the government's priorities, and what is your opinion on how those have been over the last years?
Well, we're in a big black box right now because we're about to head into a new election. We have a new Liberal leader, Mark Carney, who looks like he has the momentum right now, thanks to Trump. To win the next election. If that's the case, then there should be some positive movement on climate change. However, it needs to be pointed out that if Carney loses, Poilievre is very much a doubter, a skeptic of climate change, and would probably focus much more on fossil fuels. And Carney himself has some personal conflicts of interest in terms of his activities as an economist and activities as an investment banker, and the fact that some of his investments are supposedly tied to fossil fuels.
Yeah, so we're heading a little bit already to the discussion on divestment. That's something that I want to touch a little bit later on more. But for the previous years, how would you describe or summarize how this environment was for the investments?
For Canada, I think that we would probably, if we were giving grades out in terms of climate change policies, we would probably be at a B- or a C+. I'm just starting some research now on the results of the Inflation Reduction Act. That was a major policy that was passed by Biden in 2022. And what it did was make huge investments in clean energy. We haven't done anything like that in Canada. And so while Canada, the previous Trudeau government, talked a lot about climate change and did make some actions in that direction, it was nowhere near the scope that is required. You know, one small example of that, obviously, is that Trudeau bought this oil pipeline that is shipping oil from Alberta into Burnaby now. And the fact that, in fact, the federal government, and particularly the provincial government here, have promised to move back from the carbon tax. So we're actually moving backwards, we're not moving forwards on climate change in Canada.
And this is a pretty big moment in history, right? We have for the first time surpassed for over a year the 1.5 mark lens on global climate change, above the 1.5 line. And I think that's looking ahead with the Conference of the Parts number 30 happening in Brazil and all the discussion about the Paris Agreement. There's lots going on that leads us to think how those investments were made and where we're actually heading, right?
It's a very curious aspect of human nature. There was a report going back to the early 2000s called the Stern Report, appointed by the UK government. And he was one of the head economists in the UK at the time. And he warned that if we didn't invest in climate change mitigation and adaptation, that in fact markets would go awry. And we're starting to see markets in big trouble in terms of insurance, for flood insurance, in terms of coastal areas, in terms of the devastation by wildfires. And yet we as humans, and because of our political system being so short-term oriented, are unable to match the challenge that is posed to us by climate change.
Okay, yes, that's true. And I think that speaks a lot to where I'm trying to head with this conversation. Because one of the things that that we're trying to understand here is for regular people, Burnaby, Vancouver residents, how does, I'm going to call it momentum again, how when we're looking about the current investments, all this political scenario, how do these affect the everyday of Vancouver metropolitan region residents?
Well, just think about the fact that a few years ago we had a town in the eastern part of the Fraser Valley, Lytton, that burned to the ground because of climate change. Think about the fact that, you know, we're 97 or 98% dependent upon hydroelectricity, and climate change is likely to change the precipitation patterns. That means our electricity system is vulnerable. Think about the mountain pine beetle that has devastated our forestry sector, and it's because we haven't had the same kinds of winters we had before climate change. So all of these things are directly affecting BC residents, even though they don't feel it on a day-to-day basis. And because they don't feel it on a day-to-day basis, there isn't enough push for political action.
Yes, I think that's true. And I also think that something that speaks to that is that people don't understand actually what are the policies they're supposed to be upholding. I mean, we've seen a growing discussion in how, for example, electrical cars are not actually that beneficial to the environment as they were promised to be. We look at a lot of discussions, which of the industries, when you're talking about clean energy, are the most effective. And I know that you have a lot of background in this. You've recently published your article on the solar panels. We also discussed recently a lot about nuclear energy. There was your recent panel on the hydrogen energy. And so for you, among all everything that you've seen so far in the research group and in your own research, what are the key industries that should be prioritized and that people need to understand more so that they can push for policies in that direction?
So the interesting thing when we go back to the political question for a political scientist is, how do we get the public interested in disasters that might happen 5 to 10 to 15 years from now? And the answer is that it could be a win-win situation. That is, whenever you're at the start of a new revolution, whether it's the automobile,